This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Connecticut wants to stop fracking waste at the border. Democrats are suing the state over its campaign finance laws. A state construction company, is being investigated by the feds for the way it contracts with minority business. And could Governor Malloy face a challenge from his own party? And we're not talking Lee Whitman here. Today, Where We Live, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, where we'll tackle these stories. We'll also consider what Hillary Clinton told a Yukon crowd about the state of journalism today. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can always email wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. Joining us today is Colin McEnroe. He's host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. You've been on the disabled list. It's good to have you back, Colin.
I'm here to talk about jobs and education.
Well, we're going to get to
or education and jobs, John. You decide, John.
We're going to talk about
it. Doesn't matter.
Jobs and education in just a moment here, Colin. Mark Pasdiokas is here. He's Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Hi, Paz.
Hi.
And Christine Storth, editor of CT News Junkie. Hello, Christine.
Good morning.
And we want to welcome back Patrick Scahill, who covers science for WNPR as well as other things. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, John.
So first, we're going to start with some important fallout from the state budget. It seems as though the state legislature's nonpartisan Office of Fiscal Analysis estimates that income tax receipts for the current budget will fall about $357 million short of what had been budgeted. Now, this means that the surplus that the Malloy administration had been touting for this year just got a lot smaller. And as we'll talk about in a minute, it has an impact on two topics, a tax rebate that he'd earlier proposed and also keno gambling. But first, I just want to get from Paz and Christine what people are saying about this at the Capitol. Are surprised at these numbers, the fact that we're not getting as much tax revenue as we expected?
Some, but there have been inklings for quite a while, and there've been a quiet resistance springing up to the wisdom of the governor's rebate plan. So, in a weird way, there was a little bit of relief, I think, the other day that the loss in projected revenue was so great that they didn't have to struggle over it. It was like, sorry, Governor, it's gone. It's done. It's like trying to decide whether you're going to save an old car or something, and then the mechanic says, no, it's going to cost you $15,000, and you're relieved. You go, okay, I don't have to even think about this anymore. We're done.
I don't think anybody spent the $55, but there were a lot of plans for those $55 to go to some Second Amendment supporters and some Republican candidates. So they are the real losers in the $55 rebate going away.
But you know, when lawmakers are getting together and taking a look at this entire situation with the state budget right now, you know, you're just reporting, Christine, co-chairs of Finance Revenue Bonding Committee. They get together. They say, just like the governor, we don't want to increase taxes here. But look, we don't have the money that we thought we had going in. We're not going to do this $55 rebate, but what else is now off the table?
What else is off the table? They're going to defer some of the tax breaks they were going to give. And these are some of the tax breaks or some of the taxes that went into effect in 2011 when Malloy's first budget went into effect. So some of those are probably going to have to be deferred until future dates.
Yeah, there was a teacher retirement's benefit that they were going to do, and they'll probably just stretch that out.
Over-the-counter prescription drugs.
And what they do is they rarely say, we were wrong and we are going to repeal a tax break. They just defer the date by which it takes effect.
Yes.
Now, Colin, I know you want to talk about jobs and education, but first I have to ask you some other questions. I hope you won't mind.
As long as you understand that's item one.
Okay, that is item one. I want to talk about this $55 tax rebate. So Governor Malloy proposes it, and then he says just the other day, look, we're not going to be able to do this because of this slight hole in the budget that we've worn up here over the course of the last couple of days. What exactly does this mean, do you think, for the governor, that he comes out and says, we're going to give back $55 to everyone, whether or not that was a wise thing or not, and then says, we're not going to give $55 back to everyone?
I think this is a question that could be answered by the average fifth grader. It's just really embarrassing to promise all your friends something and then not have it for them. So, I mean, what's sort of amazing to me about this was a really bad idea to begin with. I think, you know, we all agree the rebate was a bad idea to begin with. Bad ideas usually aren't amenable to this kind of modification. They usually just go forward no matter what. And so it was $155 million, is that what it took?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm amazed that they just don't find it somewhere. I mean, $155 million isn't chump change, but sort of in the scheme of things, you know, and the way that they ordinarily manage to move money around and bond for something they've never bonded before, which frees up more money. I mean, it was a terrible idea, but as you suggested to him on the air, not to great receptiveness on his part, it's a political disaster to pull it off the table. It just looks like you don't know what you're doing.
But I think that that's one of the things that's interesting is that there really must be a hole here because, as Colin suggests, we seem to be able to, through the budgetary process, find money in various locations. And if $155 million is necessary to pay for something that we've said we're going to do, why can't they find $155 million?
Well, that's why I said there's a sense of relief at the Capitol, because it was going to be a really dumb argument out there. Yeah, we had heard that come hell or high water, the administration was saying we're going to save the rebate. And people like Pat Widlitz and John Fonfara on, you know, the revenue, you know, the committee that does revenue said, this is just dumb. Why do we want to have this fight? So that's why I say there was a sense of relief that when OFA, the nonpartisan, you know, fiscal unit at the legislature said, hey, guys, the numbers jumped up. The hole is $300 million plus. So just forget it. The politics of it, I mean, you know, Colin's right. It is embarrassing. I think the larger political question is, does it signify to people a fundamental problem with the economy as opposed to kind of a temporary glitch for a whole bunch of reasons that's hitting a lot of states? I think that's Malloy's bigger reelection problem. The idea that the state is still struggling is corrosive to an incumbent seeking reelection.
Let's listen to a little bit of what Governor Malloy told reporters on Monday. This was at the Capitol after he was on Where We Live talking about a little bit. There's a scrum with reporters in which he answered some questions about the status of this rebate and whether or not it was a gimmick to start with.
No, it wasn't a gimmick. I happen to firmly believe and still believe when we have lots of money come in, well in excess of what we otherwise predict, that should be shared with taxpayers. Let's be very clear. My position is not different. Circumstances are different. We've gone from a $3.6 billion deficit. We're going to have a surplus this year. We're going to be in balance. We're just not going to have as much money as we thought because of one particular tax, which is an important tax when you consider the extent of wealth in certain parts of our state.
And then Malloy laid some blame on the expiration of the Bush tax cuts. Here's how House Minority Leader Larry Caffaro responded to that.
You screwed up. You did the wrong thing. Take it on the chin and move on. George Bush.
Okay, so that's Larry Caffaro. And, of course, we'll all miss Larry Caffaro when he leaves the Capitol because he does make for a good soundbite. Christine, talk a little bit about the politics on this because I did try to engage Governor Malloy in a question about the politics of this. At the end of the day, when you say you're going to do something and then you don't do something, it, of course, looks bad and it's maybe a little bit embarrassing. But is there more to it than just that when we start to hear, you know, excuses about Bush-era tax credits and whatnot?
Well, I mean, look at what the strategy was from the beginning. In 2011, he came in and he increased, you know, taxes, second largest tax increase in the history of Connecticut. And I think when they did that, they were hoping by this time that they would be able to offer this package and give something back to taxpayers. And the consensus revenue estimates in January would have allowed them to do that, but those were obviously wrong. And so he finds himself in this predicament. You know, I think that he's doing the right thing by obviously not trying to find $155 million in the budget to go forward with this. But it's I don't know how much voters are going to remember this $55 when they go to the polls.
I mean, first of all, I've always wondered whether this is a great political gesture even to begin with. It has a little bit of the feeling of some kingpin peeling off a couple of bills from his wad and saying, hey, go buy yourself something nice. I also have to assume, I mean, it would have been fascinating to know the conversations that went on, first of all, between Governor Malloy's OPM people or whoever was in dialogue with the legislature, because I'm assuming the Pat Widlitzes of the world did sort of say, don't make us do this. We can't do this. And I'm sure there was a lot of push and pull. And then there must have been kind of a tantrum scene in the office at some point when they really sort of had to confront the fact that that disastrously they have to say that they can't do this.
The way that the governor frames this, of course, is it was a tax rebate targeted to Connecticut citizens who were paying gas taxes, for instance, and that was a way to, you know, get around those folks having to pay taxes but still being able to tax the people who are coming through the state and paying gas taxes. When he explains it that way, Colin, does it make a lot more sense to you?
And, you know, I heard him say that on your show, and I was thinking, well, maybe you should set up toll booths then. If you're that concerned about people coming through the state and using our highways and you want to stick it to them, maybe we should reignite the toll booth conversation.
And reignite is a bad choice of words, given how the tolls
good
came
point,
off.
Good point. Yeah.
We're talking on the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, about some of the news of the week, including what happened at the Capitol this week, the $55 tax rebate going off the books, not a possibility anymore because of a shortfall in tax incomes. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We're going to move to Keno in just a moment, which is another one of the outgrowths of this. But I just want to ask that Larry Kafarocut gets at something else, Paz, that I think from a political standpoint, we need to talk about Malloy's reelection campaign. Many Republicans and probably some Democrats have said it's now almost 4 years through your first term. Probably talking about the budget deficit you inherited as often as you do, we'll have to stop at a certain point. But even other parts of our conversation the other day when he was here, he was talking about Common Core being something that Jody Rell signed into law, and the George Bush tax credits being the problem. And there is a sense among some, certainly, that he will need to, in this reelection campaign, stake out some of his own ground, not based on what he inherited, but what he actually has done during his time in office.
A couple things. It is true that the problems he inherited are in large measure the root causes of the fiscal situation today.
And they were huge.
However, there's really no graceful way to keep beating that drum. You know, it's interesting. The state of New Jersey also referred to the Bush-era tax cuts expiring and how everybody ran and to cash in their capital gains before the rates went up. But they didn't describe it that way. You know, it was simply the expiration of certain, you know, tax benefits caused people to sell off assets, and, you know, all the revenue came in a year ahead of time. Because New Jersey has, you know, like a $600 million hole in their revenue projections as well. But you're right. People, after a while, it does come across as whining. So it's more really a political question than an economic question. I mean, we have a story on the page today that Keith Faniff did, economists talking about all the factors that have gone into this problem. By and large, the economy is beyond the reach of any single governor. You can certainly take issue with tax policies and other things, but you're up against a tide that one governor, generally speaking, cannot change.
And one of the things, yeah, Fred Carstensen says in that, is sequestration. There's a bunch of federal-level problems at work here that are causing this problem for states.
But voters look at who the chief executive is. I mean, that's just a fact of politics. It's a very hard thing to get around.
And the harsh reality is that this budget they're passing, you know, whatever that it ends up being, is going to be balanced. But in 2016, there's going to be a $1 billion deficit. So whoever is governor is going to also inherit a $1 billion deficit in that year. So
before we move to Keno, Colin, just a quick last thought on this.
Well, I mean, I think Paz is right, although I would say there may be a graceful way to talk about some of these historic problems and the way they show up three and a half
years. I'm saying
Dan
Malloy has not found the graceful way.
He is so far from finding the graceful way of talking about this that it's ludicrous. And I was re-listening to the Monday show today, this morning, you know, and just, I mean, when he talked about Common Core, he kind of snapped at it. He said, I didn't put it in Common Core. And he's got to stop doing that. I mean, if he runs against Tom Foley, his lack of gracefulness will be less of a problem, perhaps, because Mr. Foley doesn't have that much himself. But, you know, listening to him on your show, cutting off this caller who's trying to ask a question about late-in-life judges being appointed out, to the point where he was really effectively shouting her down as she was trying to ask a question on the air, you know, he seems even a little more on edge right now than he typically is. Although, you know, that the scale of Dan Malloy tension is, you know, is a different one from the what most of us have. But he seems very much on edge. And in all of these statements, I think he does have to find a slightly more accommodating tone.
One of the things that I talked to him, of course, is about Keno. This is something that became state law at the 11th hour, sort of under the dark of night at the end of last legislative session. It's something that polls show not a lot of Connecticut residents are all that happy with, and there have been some bills on the table to repeal Keno before it even gets started. So I asked Governor Malloy about Keno and whether or not, if indeed a repeal bill came to his desk, he would look to repeal Keno. Here's what he said.
I'm not a Keno advocate. I know that there are advocates in the legislature. I know that there are people who don't like Keno. I understand all of that. It's got to get to my desk. But I was very clear, I think before the session even started, that legislation came to me, I'd sign it.
But are you going to push for repeal of Keno?
I think I just did, John. I said I called for it, which I did before the session, and I've repeatedly said that I would sign it. So I am calling for it.
So, Christine, and you quoted this in one of your stories. So does this mean that the governor of the state is saying we don't want Keno in the state and that the lawmakers now, before the end of this legislative session, are going to take up bills to repeal Keno?
Nobody is taking responsibility for Keno. So it came and became part of the budget last year and, you know, in closed-door budget negotiations, and nobody wants to take responsibility for it.
Nobody's taking responsibility for it, but is anybody taking responsibility now? If nobody wants it, can't it just die? Can't somebody just get rid of it?
It can't, because the revenue projections are lagging that much. So they can't get rid of it now. So now they're stuck with it, and voters hate it, and they're going to have to deal with that.
I'm just wondering how plausible that is, Pez, from everything we've seen. The first year, almost no real revenues coming in from Keno. The next year and the next year after that, we're talking, and the lottery corporations told us maybe $17 to $30 million tops of revenue. That's going to plug a little tiny bit of the hole that we got right now.
Keno also is an expansion of the rest of the lottery's products. You know, anybody who sets up Keno in their bar or restaurant, they're going to sell this stuff. So there's going to be some other revenue. I think the lottery's view is this is a long-term expansion. It's a protection of their market. The lottery runs like a company. They look at market share. They look at how do they freshen their product line. The state of Connecticut relies on the Connecticut Lottery for more than $300 million a year. That's more than the two casinos, you know, kick back to the state on their slots revenues. So the lottery is not an insignificant player in Connecticut. I question, you know, whether there'll be really any political price to pay when Keno shows up. It really is not a big deal as far as how it changes a restaurant or a bar. I'm not saying that the opponents of gambling don't have a point, that it does represent an expansion of gambling, and that's really what they're, you know, concerned about. But Keno's here to stay. I mean, nobody wants to own it, but it's in the budget that was passed last year. There would have to be an affirmative act to take it out. There's no way in hell in this environment you're going to take a dime out of that budget.
But the governor just told me, Colin, he's going to push for repeal of Keno. He doesn't want it here in the state. Well, Isn't that good enough?
It's clear now whose fault this is and who's responsible for it. Mark Pazniokas has now made the most definitive statement about Keno of anybody that Keno is here to stay. He is absolutely more on record than any legislator or any member of the executive branch. So, I mean, he owns it now. It's his problem. But, you know, I do think Christine's original point was correct. In the, you know, most of human life can be understood through the old cartoon panel, A Family Circus. And there was this little ghost called Not Me who would go around knocking things off, you know. And Not Me was the person who always, you know, broke the lamp and stuff like that. And just in the way that Keno arose as the product of Not Me, this little ghost who runs around putting things in budgets, so also will the repeal of Keno be impossible, because since nobody ever caused it in the first place, nobody, and you, as you listen to Malloy on that tape, nobody's really going to take responsibility for getting rid of it. I mean, you pressed him on this a little bit, and he, you know, said, I think I just did call for the repeal of it. All right, well, if you really want to repeal it, you're the governor. You probably can. It's a Democratic legislature. But for all the reasons, structural reasons that Paz is talking about, that's not going to happen.
I never took you for a big Family Circus fan.
Oh, Colin, you can understand everything you need to know.
This is twice, at least twice, since I have been here. He has used that.
He's invoked the Family Circus. Colin McEnroe.
He did this so the first time apologetically, though.
Colin McEnroe is host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. He's a big fan of the Family Circus. Mark Pazniokas is Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror. He owns Keno now. Christine Stewart is editor of CT News Junkie. She knows what she's talking about. And in a little bit, we'll be bringing on Patrick Scahill, who covers science for us here. And we're going to take your calls at 860-275-7266. We're going to talk about a lawsuit by Democrats against state campaign finance laws. We're going to talk about a possible challenge from the left for Governor Malloy. And we'll also talk about fracking waste. It's all coming up in the Wheelhouse right after this break. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, and we're visiting with an all-star panel of reporters, including Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror, Christine Stewart, editor of CT News Junkie. In just a bit, we'll bring in Patrick Scahill, who covers science for WNPR, and Colin McEnroe is back in his regular chair. He's host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's on your show this afternoon, Colin?
We're talking about villains today. I've got this whole theory that people don't understand what a villain is anymore. They think Walter White from Breaking Bad is a hero. So we're going to talk about sort of the very nature of the idea of a villain.
I love this idea of villains this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show and always online at WNPR.org. We've been talking a bit about some of the things I talked about with Governor Daniel Malloy earlier this week when he was on the show. We talked for a moment about why he decided to make his campaign announcement that he was running for re-election before the end of the legislative session. He had earlier said that he was going to wait until the session was over. Here's what he said.
I was attempting not to, make sure that the 10-10 minimum wage was not overly politicized in the sense of tying it to an election cycle. And so when I saw that we were going to get 10-10 done, which, by the way, speaks to women, 60% of minimum wage earners in Connecticut are women and they are raising families. When I saw that we were going to get that done, actually be the first in the nation to do it, then I started to concentrate on what I was going to do. Had some conversations with my wife, Kathy, had some conversations with Nancy Wyman, the lieutenant governor. She, in turn, spoke to her husband. We made a decision and we announced it.
So that was why he decided to announce it in the middle of a legislative session as opposed to after the session, Colin, when he said he was going to announce it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of questions that I have about this. My first question is that if Nancy Wyman had said, you know, Dan, I think we've had a good run. Let's not run again. I wonder if you would have said, all right, your call, really. But, I mean, you know, even to me, anyway, this sort of parsing that response, it's a little odd the way that he answers the question because he says he doesn't want to politicize the raising of the minimum wage to 10-10. And then parenthetically within – he doesn't even wait for another sentence. He says – and that really speaks to women. And I don't know how to interpret that as other than a political statement. I mean obviously maybe he means that addresses the concerns of women. But it almost sounded like he was – obviously in that response he mentioned women as many times as he possibly could. He talked about talking with his wife, talking to Nancy Wyman, helping women out with the minimum wage. It sounded like a political answer even in the part that was explicit. Explicitly non-political.
It sounded like it was. That was the most generous appraisal of that bit of tape. Wow. Yeah, I mean, you give a series of talking points that sound like they were road tested and, you know, with focus groups, and then say it wasn't political. Look, the minimum wage is 100% political. Doing it this year, doing it under these circumstances, he wanted to make headlines, being the first. It tied in with what the president was doing. It's won him a lot of friends in Washington. The Democratic Governors Association has mentioned it as one of the issues that makes Connecticut on the front lines for them for defending the governor's reelection. So
they even mentioned it in the lawsuit.
Yeah, exactly.
The minimum wage was mentioned in the Democratic Governors Association lawsuit against the state.
It parenthetically. And yes. did they say in the lawsuit it's also good for women?
They didn't say that.
They said they were the first in the country. But.
And it did say in a subsequent filing that they did say it puts Connecticut on the front line. So come on, Governor. It is political. There's nothing wrong with it being political. And it's also, look, there are a lot of people who think it's good public policy. So just embrace the politics.
And that's the thing. There's nothing wrong with it being political because it is a political year. We're going to go to the lawsuit in just a moment. But quickly, over the weekend, former state lawmaker, education blogger Jonathan Pelto appeared on WFSB's Face the State with our friend Dennis Housie, opened up the possibility of challenging Governor Malloy from the left.
When you look at education, higher education, his tax policies, his commitment to campaign finance reform and transparency, you see a whole pattern that those of us who I guess you'd call more liberal, more progressive, would say, wait a minute, that's not the person that we elected.
So John Pelto, I think we all know him. He has been certainly a thorn in the side of the Malloy administration over the course of the last few years, especially on the issue of education. He has a lot of people, especially in teachers' unions, who follow him very, very closely. I'll ask you first, Paz, but I'd like everyone to jump in. Does John Pelto getting into this or maybe even threatening to get into this affect this race at all?
If he can get on the ballot as an independent, and you know, there's no way he's going to try to challenge Malloy for the Democratic nomination. But the question here is, can he get on the ballot on a third-party line and be a spoiler? And he's quite open if you when you push him. I mean, I've had a couple of conversations with him now. He doesn't like the word spoiler, but yes, he acknowledges that he would get into defeat Governor Malloy. And so therefore, to win friends on the left, he has to construct an argument in which he convinces unions and progressives that the state of Connecticut and these constituency groups would be better off with Tom Foley, John McKinney, Mark Boughton, et cetera, as governor. And needless to say, he's finding that's a very hard sell.
Mm. Christine?
You know, it's not going to – it's 7,500 signatures if Jonathan Pelto wants to get on the ballot. I think that he can certainly get on the ballot. He's a smart political analyst. I think that
– But it's 100,000 to get the money. I mean,
right,
yeah.
To be able to access the public campaign funds. So, you know, that is obviously a more difficult task. But at the same time, I think that we saw in 2010 – Tom Marsh, running on the independent line, received 17,629 votes. So, you know, definitely was a spoiler in that race, you know, for the most part for Tom Foley. So it, you know.
And there's a very strong Bridgeport angle here. I mean, one of the governor's really most unfortunate political battles he's taken on is he has been supportive of the charter school folks in Bridgeport. You know, this is there's a lot of angles down here. I don't pretend to know them all, but to simplify it is you do have a parents group down there who has resisted efforts to have a superintendent imposed, to have a state takeover. And these people have won at every level. So Bridgeport is one of the big important sources of Democratic votes. And right now, all the operatives who have been successful in the last year or so are folks who are not terribly happy with the governor right now.
I think we could say that the larger issue is where does the Democratic Party fall on education reform?
Yeah.
Mm. Colin?
I don't think there's any question, as Christine was just implying. This would be a disaster, a disaster for Dan Malloy. I mean, he won this last election by 6,000 votes. For Pelto to show up on the ballot and start pulling from these constituency groups that Mark and that we're talking about right now, that Mark and Christine are talking about right now, it would be a disaster. Now, my guess is there are going to be a lot of conversations, to whatever degree there are elder statesmen left in the party to talk to Jonathan Pelto. I think there will be conversations in which they try to convince him. And I think the name Ralph Nader will be invoked repeatedly. The way that Ralph was demonized by a lot of people after the 2000 election and the degree to which Ralph, I think, did suffer a personal toll. I mean, the number of people who sort of blamed him for things. I think Jonathan will probably be reminded of that by other people.
But this issue of education reform, as Christine just talked about, and where the Democratic Party in Connecticut stands in education reform, this really is quite a battle. And it's a battle that a lot of people take, frankly, more seriously. And I see it on my Twitter feed and I see it in emails that people send to me. More seriously than almost any other issue in the state and are more energized by this than any other issue that we talk about on the air.
Absolutely. And the question to them becomes, do you want to, in the parlance of Vietnam, burn a village in order to save it? In other words, by supporting Jonathan Pelto, it seems unlikely to me, unless you have a Republican candidate who delivers really what it is that you're looking for, you're taking a big risk.
Paz, could you explain why the Democratic Governors Association has sued the state over its campaign finance laws and what exactly happens with this?
The Democratic Governors Association is concerned about a couple of things. One is the governor's aggressive fundraising on their behalf. Will that now render independent expenditures that the DGA intends to make to support his reelection something less than independent? Would it be considered illegal coordination under Connecticut state law? So that's a piece of it. Connecticut state law, when it comes to defining illegal coordination, is stricter than the federal standard. I think people have all heard these stories about, you know, independent groups are down the hall from the, you know, same consultant who's working on a campaign. In Connecticut, there is a rebuttable presumption in state law that you are illegally coordinating if you have staff that overlaps, if you have consultants that overlap. Now, in the case of the Democratic Governors Association, the Democratic Party, and Governor Malloy, you do have at least one consultant I'm aware of who's done work for all of them. That's Global Strategies. They employ Roy Okegrosso, one of the governor's most important political advisors. So you have those two big concerns. You know, the DGA intends to spend millions of dollars in support of the reelection of the governor, and the last thing they want is somebody to file a complaint, you know, midsummer to say, hey, these guys are breaking the law. So in effect, they're asking a federal court to give an advisory opinion that they couldn't get from the State Elections Enforcement Commission. They're doing so by seeking an injunction that blocks the SEEC from enforcing this provision of law. Now, it, you know, the politics of this get very messy. If they succeed, you know, you're opening some doors for the Republicans. Tom Foley already has had, you know, has established some relationships with some of these independent expenditure groups. So it's, you know, this is going to be the year that, as I've said on the show before, that money is going to be, you know, the issue.
Just a little update on Global, because I did ask Roy Okegrosso this morning, so we get it right, because if we don't get it right, we often get in a lot of trouble. So so Global is the general consultant for the Malloy campaign, which is effectively the campaign manager. They've done work for the DGA in the past. I think they billed about $250,000 worth of polling over 2 years. According to Roy, they're not doing any work for the DGA right now. But, I mean, the larger point here is there's a couple of larger points. One of them is, there's probably a really good Family Circus cartoon about you should have thought about this sooner. If you're going to use Dan Malloy as this, you know, fundraising spear point, you should look down the road and wonder whether you're going to run into a problem there. And I wonder if it just never occurred to them what the Connecticut campaign laws say about this. So that's point one. And point two is, you know, in a larger sense, Dan Malloy came along at a time when public financing was a relatively new thing, and he really was a symbol of it too. He was a symbol of all of the kind of post-Roland election reforms and what they can do and what they can do for a candidate. And I think for the most part, people had a pretty good feeling about that, causing him to get elected or helping him to get elected anyway. And now he's like a cat who crawled up the great drapes and now wants to claw the drapes to pieces. It seems, yeah, this isn't specific to the DGA thing, but it seems like he wants to shred a lot of the things that got him here in the first place, and that's an unattractive spectacle.
I want to turn to another topic that I talked about with the governor this week when he was on the show. It's about fracking waste. It's something that the legislature has been taking on. Of course, we can't really frack for natural gas here in Connecticut, but nearby states can, and they need a place to send that waste. I'm not exactly sure what's in that waste, so some lawmakers are saying that we need to stop it. I talked with Governor Malloy about this problem. Here's what he had to say.
We may benefit from having the availability at market rate prices of a commodity, which is natural gas. But unlike Pennsylvania or New York, if they get into the business on a large-scale basis, or places like Texas or Oklahoma, we don't receive a fee. In essence, a tax on that which is taken out of the ground. That's their problem. Let's be very clear. Texas, you take care of your problem. You want to sell a commodity in the marketplace, you take care of your problem. Oklahoma, you want to sell a product on the marketplace, you take care of it. We have no obligation at all to accept waste from other states.
So I want to bring in Patrick Scahill, WNPR science reporter, who's been covering this story for us. And Patrick, he was responding there to a piece of tape I played for him from one of your stories from a Yale environmentalist, if I have that right, talking about whether or not Connecticut needs to be ready to bear some of the environmental burden from fracking waste, whether or not we can literally say, no, we don't want that stuff here if we're already going to be taking in the very cheap natural gas that the other states are providing.
Right. So the person we played was Jim Sayers. He he's in the Yale School of Forestry. And basically, Jim was saying, you know, as you just said, hey, look, if Connecticut is looking to expand its gas infrastructure by, I think, 280,000 new customers over the next 10 years, maybe we should be bearing some of that environmental cost. And we put the question to Governor Malloy. And, well, we just heard his response there.
Essentially, he doesn't think that we should bear the environmental cost. But what does he think we should be doing with the fracking waste? He's talking about stopping waste at the borders. What does that say to you?
Right. Well, so there's two bills that are currently working their way through the legislature. One, which seems to not have any momentum at this point, is to ban this waste entirely from coming into the state. This was sort of the one that all the folks in the Senate who supported this measure and in the House were kind of championing at the start of the session, saying, we're going to ban this stuff. It's not coming here at all. We are going to stop trucks at the border. And then people raised that concern. They said, hey, you know, DEEP is very understaffed. You're probably not going to be stopping these trucks at the border. That's not really a feasible thing. So how about we initiate a moratorium? And this is something that seems to have a little bit more momentum here. So the moratorium is basically a ban for somewhere, I think it's 2 years now. That could change, according to what DEEP and several other folks have said. And this would be a moratorium to sort of so the state could basically kind of look at what's in this waste and decide whether or not we want to bring it here, whether or not we want to treat it and make money off of the treatment of this waste.
But of course, and make money off the treatment of this waste, of course, we could put together really high-tech plants that would treat this waste and turn it into some sort of water we could use for something, and everyone wins. The problem is, as I outlined with the governor, as you outlined in your reporting, again, we'll go back to the Bush administration. There's some laws on the books right now that make it very hard to figure out what's in this stuff. I mean, beyond really serious chemical analysis at some place like Yale or UConn.
Right. So there's a few problems. One, as you said, what's in it? We don't know. A lot of it's proprietary and it's protected as a so-called trade secret. The other problem is, you know, honestly, this waste probably won't make its way here. It's not really economically feasible for it to come here. This is something that Jim Sayers told me. You know, if you're fracking in Pennsylvania, the cost to ship the waste here to Connecticut, it doesn't make sense. You know, why not just store it in Ohio if you can?
Just put it in Ohio.
Put it in a deep well in Ohio.
It's fine.
The long-term problem with that, of course, is, okay, so what if Ohio runs out of space to dispose of this waste? Then what happens? So maybe, you know, if New England is buying some of this energy, they should be bearing some of the costs. And actually, other states, Vermont has banned it. Ban this fracking waste, and Massachusetts is currently considering a ban similar to what Connecticut is.
Paz, did you want to jump in?
No, it's just politically, it's one of those things that it's so easy, right? You're
exactly.
Banning something. There's no economic interest here. There's nobody really pushing back. That's all.
I just have to ask Christine, is it really true that in – because I saw this on CT News Junkie – is it really true in New York they were using it to de-ice the roads?
Yes, yeah. That is true.
That is true.
That is one of the
– very salty. Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's very salty. It has concentrations of salt that in some cases it's like 10 times more than seawater. And it's been used as a de-icer in several states.
Yeah. And I think for artisanal pickling, there are some possibilities too.
It also may be slightly radioactive.
Yeah. Fracking waste, we can pickle that.
Recycling isn't always good.
Oh, my goodness.
We can pickle everything with fracking waste.
When we come back, we're going to talk about another highway story with Patrick Scahill about the DOT. We're also going to – well, we're going to listen back to what Hillary Clinton had to say about journalists, about the job that we do, whether or not we're doing a good enough job. We're talking with Patrick Scahill from WNPR, along with Colin McInerney, also Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, and Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com. This is Where We Live.
Faith Middleton, hey garlic lovers, an easy recipe for juicy roast chicken with 40 cloves of garlic, do not be afraid, and killer good, spicy Bloody Mary meatloaf, can you imagine? At WNPR.org, search programs for those recipes to see the Faith Middleton Food Schmooze, and it's here on WNPR.
Today at 3 and 9 p.m., support comes from Aqua Pool and Patio, Goodwill Stores and Donation Centers, Plan B Burger Bar, and Asana Plastic Surgery Center and Med Spa. Support comes from the Metro Hartford Alliance and its investors, working to compete for jobs, capital, and talent in the region. Learn more about events, investors, and how the Alliance can help your business at metrohartford.com. Support also comes from the Fund for Greater Hartford and its generous support of Connecticut Public Broadcasting's Media is Magic Student Reporting Lab. Support also comes from Webster Private Bank, building financial confidence through personal attention with banking and investment services, part of Webster Bank N.A., member FDIC. Information from Peter Gabriel at 203-328-8110. You're going to see rain today, highs near 48, and rain tonight, lows around 46. Rain and wind tomorrow, too, highs near 72. Mostly sunny on Friday, highs near 65. And this weekend, there's a chance of showers, otherwise partly sunny, highs in the mid-60s.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be broadcasting live from the Hartford Hilton, and we'll be sitting down and talking with John Dean, former Nixon White House counsel, as part of the Hartford County Bar Association Conference. We'll talk with Dean about his role in the Nixon administration and the Watergate scandal and what it can tell us about public corruption today. Hope you can join us for this conversation on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're talking with Colin McEnroe, Mark Pazniokas, Christine Stewart, and Patrick Scahill. There's still a lot of things to get to. Christine, during the break, you just said something. You've been covering the legislature for years. How many bills have they gotten passed this year so far?
13.
13 bills.
With 7 days left, yes.
So how many bills would they normally have passed by this time?
Normally, it's in the hundreds.
It's in the hundreds.
Last 10 days, right. I mean, we were calculating since 2010. We've been calculating the amount of bills they passed in the last 10 days, and this is the least amount.
This is the least
amount. You haven't noticed the House and Senate leadership aren't getting along.
Yes.
So 13 bills so far. I'm sure we'll see a whole lot of bills just at the very, very end. I'm sure that it'll happen once again, right? Is that what we're going to see?
Once it's dark.
Once it's dark.
Yeah.
Once it's dark.
And then they'll say, we have to do it this way.
We have to do it. There's no other way to do it.
We can't do it the other way.
I don't think the Senate is really taking up any House bills. Now, the Senate has the capacity to move a ton of business very quickly, but still, it's a very low number for this time of the session.
Aaron from Waterbury has a question for Christine here. Hi, Aaron. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. How are you guys doing?
Good. What's up?
Well, I wanted to talk about, I guess, the current issue in Connecticut related to the nonprofit hospitals that are being converted to for-profit or are being attempted to be for-profit. I just want to get the panel's take on it.
Christine, I know this is something you've been covering. What is the state looking at here?
This is one of the issues that they have left on the table that they have not dealt with yet, in addition to the budget. So there are about four nonprofit hospitals that are seeking to convert to for-profit hospitals in the state. And there's currently a way for them to do that, and they want to change the process in how they do that. And it's been proposed in several pieces of legislation. And I guess we're still waiting to see whether they come up with an agreement.
It's unclear. I mean, the last thing Governor Malloy wants right now is any piece of legislation that might kill the deal in Waterbury. It would not be a good thing for a Democratic governor to have a hospital be declared dead in Waterbury in an election year. I don't mean to be glib. It wouldn't be good for any governor.
That's
so
right.
There's a lot of moving parts to this. And as Christine, suggests, it's being done behind closed doors. It's a negotiation.
And when we've talked with Brendan Sharkey about his reverse pilot idea about the way in which we might tax big nonprofits in town a little bit differently. He mentions this all the time. He says, look, all the hospitals are eventually going to be for-profit hospitals anyway. This is a fait accompli. It's moving in that direction, it seems.
I don't know if that's exactly true, but if they do become for-profit hospitals, they do go back onto the tax rolls for these municipalities. So that, presumably is a good thing for the municipality there.
I think Where We Live guest Steve Brill might tell you that, in effect, a lot of hospitals that are nonprofit hospitals right now are for-profit hospitals, that they are walking, swimming, and quacking like for-profit hospitals.
We've certainly heard that before on the show. I want to get to a story that Patrick Scahill's been covering with our Jeff Cohen here, and it has to do with the way in which contractors subcontract at the state level and the way they take in federal money. It's a really interesting thing that I want to keep watching into the future. Maybe you can just explain this for us quickly, Patrick.
Yeah, so the broad strokes in this are there was a $2.4 million settlement announced a few weeks ago for a Plainville construction company, Manafort Construction. And they were hit with this, essentially it was a fine, because of some impropriety with their minority subcontracting work. So big picture again, when it comes to a road project, in this case it was Route 72 in Bristol, for a contracting company in the state to qualify for federal funds, they have to prove to the state DOT that a certain amount of their work is being done by quote-unquote minority-owned businesses. So these are businesses owned by either minorities or women. And the way this works is once they can prove that some of that work is being subcontracted to those groups, they can qualify for federal Department of Transportation funding.
So this is a way to get federal money
into
a project, but they've got to prove that they're working with a minority contractor.
Yes.
What did Manafort do wrong here?
Well, according to what the federal government says, there was a company that was identified in the indictment as company number one. So Jeff Cohen and I submitted a FOIA request to find out who that was. We found out it was a Hartford-based company called JFC Construction. And what the federal prosecutors are alleging in this case is that Manafort was essentially using JFC as a pass-through. So they were saying this company was doing the work, but in fact the federal prosecutors again are alleging that JFC was not. They were just subcontracting the work out to other businesses that Manafort was going to use anyway, businesses presumably that were not minority-owned companies.
So one of the implications here is that a minority-owned business like the one that's in this lawsuit essentially is just a pass-through. It's not really able to do the work, isn't a primary contractor on a job like this. So they're not really doing anything, and Manafort is just using this as a way to get federal dollars in.
Yeah, and this is something that the federal government is saying is sort of a systemic problem. There are a lot of great minority-owned subcontracting companies that are out there, and this is something that Fred McKinney, who runs the New England Minority Business Exchange, talked about. But there are some unscrupulous ones too, and they kind of ruin the entire system for the good players here. Unscrupulous folks who are willing to act as a pass-through, as the feds are alleging JFC may have done in this case.
And the last thing I want to ask you about, but I think this is important for our panel too, is I think there's questions about how much the DOT at the state level knows about this, how much they're able to sort of sign off on whether or not one of these contracts is being done the right way. Does the federal government getting involved in this way start to shine some light on the state DOT?
So the state DOT is saying, hey, we were actually the ones who alerted the feds to the fact that there might have been some impropriety here with Manafort and JFC. So they're saying we're not at fault here. But what is a little bit unclear at this point is how the percentages of these subcontracts are actually worked out. There's some sort of allegedly panel that's kind of this like darkroom panel that sort of determines what percentage of an overall federal contract is subcontracted out to minority businesses. And this is sort of dependent on geography and economic incomes and the project itself. So that's a little murky. And what's also sort of murky is the state oversight on this project. So that's something that the federal government is continuing to look into and that we're still looking into as well.
It's one of the stories that we'll be following here on WNPR. I want to quickly go to a phone call here. Lou is in Hamden. Lou wanted to go back to an earlier topic. Go ahead, Lou, quickly, if you would.
Sure. Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to go back to the fracking issue. Thank you so much for covering this issue. One of my concerns regarding the gentleman from Yale's comments is that saying that, you know, we don't have to be worried about the stuff coming to the state, saying that, you know, we need the gas, we have a responsibility to take the waste. These are all industry party line talking points. So it concerns me that it's coming from someone at the Yale School of Forestry. But furthermore, this is an emerging issue nationwide. I mean, we've seen cases of oil and gas companies going to great lengths to dispose of their fracking waste, and including transporting this stuff thousands of miles across state lines. The hazardous waste loophole says that they don't have to label the stuff as hazardous. They can dump sometimes radioactive solid waste in landfills. And we've also seen illegal dumping into storm drains and waterways. So, you know, to be saying that there's no risk of this kind of stuff coming here, I think is lulling folks into a false sense of security. And I think the governor hit it right on the head yesterday.
Lou, thank you very much for your phone call. I just have a few minutes left here, and I wanted to play a piece of tape. We talked before Hillary Clinton came to UConn last week, so we didn't get a chance to really recap some of what she said. But here's what she said about the profession of journalism.
Too many journalists believe that the way to present a complex, even provocative issue is by having two sides. And I used to kid them and say, well, yeah, somebody would get on and say the earth is round and you'd feel compelled to have the Flat Earth Society. And they would roll their eyes and say, well, not that bad, but sort of. And so, yes, you make room for the climate deniers. And, you know, it's okay to have people who ask hard questions about what we're going to do about climate change, who come at it in a very rigorous scientific way, but not to have people who just basically roll their eyes and say it's not happening and I'm not going to participate.
So we just have 2 minutes left. Patrick Scahill, you were there. I mean, what was your takeaway from this?
Well, the comments on journalism were interesting, and the conference itself was interesting. I mean, it was kind of like a revivalist thing. I mean, it was the nicest audience for Hillary ever, and a lot of what she was doing, I think, was kind of road testing things that she might be bringing out later if she, you know, decides eventually to do this president's run, which I will say, by the way, Susan Herbst did not ask her about and made a point to not ask her about, which was very frustrating.
If we're talking about journalism here. But it's interesting to me, Christine, she makes a point to actually, if she's going to road test some stuff, she's talking about the state of journalism today. I found that odd.
You know, it's interesting that she would do that. I mean, the state of journalism today, I think, is, you know, we've lost about 20,000 journalists over the course of the last decade who are in the job. So the job has become a little bit different. But I'm optimistic that we are going to be robust and survive moving forward.
Yeah. Paz, what do you think about what the
Hillary Clinton is? It's an absolutely legitimate criticism. It's the journalist dilemma since the beginning of time. You know, we have this natural inclination to present all sides. And guess what? Not all sides of an argument should be given equal weight. And that instantly puts the journalist under tricky ground of making judgments. And that's why you do have this on the one hand, on the other hand. So on the other hand, you know, is there a good reason to do it that way?
And on the other hand, Colin?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that NPR in particular is struggling with right now. The term for it is he said, she said journalism. And I, increasingly my sense is the public really does want us to tell them not just he said, she said, but, you know, bring us somewhere, bring us to a conclusion.
Well, we've brought it to a conclusion.
Yeah, there you go.
Wasn't that a nice last thing to say, Colin? I think that they did that at the end of the Family Circus, as a matter of fact. Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, thank you so much for joining us.
Jobs and Education.
Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Read him at ctmirror.org. Thanks,
Blake Paz. Kino.
Christine Stewart, editor of ctnewsjunkie.com. Thank you, Christine.
Thanks, John.
And thanks to WNPR science reporter Patrick Scahill. Read his new blog, The Beaker.
Yes, thanks, John.
This is Where We Live.